2. Punctuation and grammar. "Damn the semicolons," cried the captain. "Full speed ahead." The poet Caroline Kaiser said to me once, "Poets are interested mostly in death and commas. Maybe storytellers are interested mostly in life and commas. If you aren't interested in punctuation, or are afraid of it, you're missing out on some of the most beautiful, elegant tools a writer has to work with. This topic is closely related to the last one, because punctuation tells the reader how to hear your writing. That's what it's for. Commas and periods bring out the grammatical structure of a sentence. They make it clear to the understanding and the emotions by showing what it sounds like, where the breaks come, where to pause. If you read music, you know that rests are signs for silence. Punctuation marks serve very much the same purpose. The period means stop for a moment. The semicolon means pause, and the comma means either pause very briefly or expect some change. The dash is a pause that sets a phrase apart. Those words make sense if you work at it a bit. The work you're doing to make sense of them is punctuating them. There are some firm rules of punctuation, but there's almost always a good deal of personal choice. The way I'd do it, in this case, is the period means stop for a moment. The semicolon means pause, and the comma means either pause very briefly or expect some change. The dash is a pause that sets a phrase apart. Some alternate choices are possible, but the wrong choices alter the meaning or lose meaning altogether. The period means stop. For a moment, the semicolon means pause, and the comma means either. Pause very briefly or expect. Some change the dash is a pause that sets a phrase apart. Some people who are ambitious about their writing and work hard on it in other ways breezily dismiss punctuation. Who cares where a comma goes? Once upon a time, sloppy writers could count on copy editors to put the commas where they belong and correct grammatical errors. But the copy editor is an endangered species these days. As for the stuff in your computer that pretends to correct your punctuation or grammar, disable it. These programs are on a pitifully low level of competence. They'll chop your sentences short and stupidify your writing. Competence is up to you. You're on your own out there with those man-eating semicolons. I can't separate punctuation from grammar, because to a large extent, learning how to write grammatically is learning how to punctuate, and vice versa. Every writer I know has at least one manual of grammar to consult in case of doubt. Publishers often insist on the Chicago Manual of Style as the final authority, but its absolute and often arbitrary commandments, aimed for the most part at expository writing, don't always apply to narrative. The same is true of most college textbooks on style. I use an old manual, The Elements of Style, by Strunk and White. It's honest, clear, funny, and useful. Like all grammarians, Strunk and White are implacable in their opinions. And so an opposition movement has inevitably grown up. You can find newer and trendier guides. A brilliant and reliable handbook recently revised is Karen Elizabeth Gordon's The Well-Tempered Sentence, a punctuation handbook for the innocent, the eager, and the doomed. Ever since the Greeks, even in the Dark Ages, schools taught grammar as a foundation and essential element of education. In America, the early grades used to be called grammar school. But toward the end of the last century, many of our schools all but stopped teaching grammar. Somehow we're supposed to be able to write without knowing anything about the equipment we're using. We're supposed to express ourselves, to squeeze out the orange juice of our souls, without being given anything to do it with, not even a knife to cut the orange. Do we expect somebody to fix our kitchen sink without tools? Do we expect somebody to stand up and play the violin without having learned how to play the violin? Writing a sentence that expresses what you want to say isn't any easier than plumbing or fiddling. It takes craft. Opinion piece, correctness and morality. Many of us believed the teacher who scolded us in second grade, "Billy, it's wrong to say, 'It's me.' Say, 'It is I.'" Many of us cower before the grammar bullies who tell us that people who say, "hopefully," are wrong. Hopefully, some of us will continue to protest. Morality and grammar are related. Human beings live by the word. Socrates said, "The misuse of language induces evil in the soul." I've had that sentence pinned up over my desk for a long time. Lying is the deliberate misuse of language, but language misused through mere ignorance or carelessness breeds half-truths, misunderstandings, and lies. In that sense, grammar and morality are related. In that sense, a writer's moral duty is to use language thoughtfully and well. But Socrates wasn't talking about correctness. Correct usage is not right, or incorrectness wrong morally. Correctness isn't a moral issue, but a social and political one, often a definition of social class. Correct usage is defined by a group of those who speak and write English a certain way, and uses a test or shibboleth to form an in-group of those who speak and write English that way, and an out-group of those who don't. And guess which group has the power? I detest the self-righteousness of the correctness bullies, and I distrust their motives. But I have to walk a razor's edge in this book because the fact is that usage, particularly in writing, is a social matter, a general social agreement about how we make ourselves understood. Incoherent syntax, mistaken words, misplaced punctuation, all cripple meaning. Ignorance of the rules makes hash of the sentences. In written prose, incorrect usage, unless part of a conscious, consistent dialect or personal voice, is disastrous. An egregious mistake in usage can invalidate a whole story. How can a reader trust a writer, ignorant of the medium she works in? Who can dance to a fiddler who plays off-key? Our standards for writing are different than for speaking. They have to be, because when we read, we don't have the speaker's voice and expression and intonation to make half-finished sentences and misused words clear. We have only the words. They must be clear. And making things clear in writing for strangers involves a lot more work than in talking face-to-face. Hence, some of the pitfalls of writing on the Internet, highly visible in email, blogs, and responses to blogs. The mechanical ease and immediacy of electronic communication are deceptive. People write hurriedly, don't reread what they wrote, misread and are misread, get into quarrels, hurl insults, and use flamethrowers because they expect their writing to be understood as if they were talking. It's childish to assume people will understand unexpressed meanings. it's dangerous to confuse self-expression with communication. The reader has only the words. Emoticons are dreary little excuses for a failure to communicate feelings and intentions in words. Using the net is easy, but getting your meaning across there is just as hard as it is in print. Perhaps harder, because it appears that a lot of people more read hastily and carelessly on the screen than on the page. Writing can be completely conversational and informal, but to communicate thought or emotion of any complexity at all, it has to follow the general agreements, the shared rules of grammar and usage. Or, if it breaks them, it breaks them intentionally. To break a rule, you have to know the rule. A blunder is not a revolution. If you don't know the real rules, you may fall for fake ones. I keep running into fake rules of good writing based on hokey grammar vocabulary. Here's an example. Fake rule. Sentences beginning "there is" are in the passive tense. Good writers never use the passive tense. Good writers use the "there is" construction all the time. There was a black widow spider on the back of his wrist. There is still hope. It's called an existential construction used to introduce a noun. It's quite basic and very useful. There's no such thing as the passive tense. Passive and active aren't tenses. They're modes of the verb. Each mode is useful and correct where appropriate. Good writers use both. Bureaucrats, politicians, administrators, etc., use the "there is" construction to avoid taking responsibility for a statement. Here is Governor Rick Scott speaking of a hurricane threat to the Republican convention in Florida. There's not an anticipation that there will be a cancellation. You can see how the innocent and useful construction got a bad name. And here's an example of deliberate violation of a fake rule. Fake rule: the generic pronoun in English is he. Violation: each one in turn reads their piece aloud. This is wrong, say the grammar bullies, because each one, each person, is a singular noun, and there is a plural pronoun. But Shakespeare used there with words such as everybody, anybody, a person. And so we all do when we're talking. It's enough to drive anyone out of their senses, said George Bernard Shaw. The grammarians started telling us it was incorrect along in the 16th or 17th century. That was when they also declared that the pronoun he includes both sexes. As in, if a person needs an abortion, he should be required to tell his parents. My use of there is socially motivated and, if you like, politically correct. A deliberate response to the socially and politically significant banning of our genderless pronoun by language legislators enforcing the notion that the male sex is the only one that counts. I consistently break a rule I consider to be not only fake, but pernicious. I know what I'm doing and why. And that's the important thing for a writer, to know what you're doing with your language and why. This involves knowing usage and punctuation well enough to use them skillfully, not as rules that impede you, but as tools that serve you. Look at the jumping frog passage on page 4. The usage is deliberately incorrect, but the punctuation is impeccable and plays a tremendous part in keeping the dialectical usages and cadences clear to the reader's ear. Careless punctuation makes a written sentence unclear and ugly. Wise punctuation keeps the flow running clear. And that's what matters. The exercise is a pure consciousness raiser. I'm trying to get you thinking about the value of punctuation by forbidding you to use it. Exercise 2. Am I Saramagu? Write a paragraph to a page, 150 to 350 words, of narrative with no punctuation and no paragraphs or other breaking devices. Suggested subject, a group of people engaged in a hurried or hectic or confused activity, such as a revolution, or the scene of an accident, or the first few minutes of a one-day sale. For a group, just for once let the group read the piece in silence first. The likelihood is that, read aloud by the author, it won't be too hard to follow. How comprehensible was it without the author's voice? To think or talk about in critiquing the exercise. How well does the unbroken flow of words fit the subject? To what extent does the unpunctuated flow actually shape the narrative? To think about after writing it. What writing it felt like. How it differed from writing with the usual signs and guides and breaks. Whether it led you to write differently from the way you usually write, or gave you a different approach to something you've tried to write. Was the process valuable? Is the result readable? If punctuation is something you've generally avoided thinking about, here's a challenge. Sit down all by yourself and go through a few paragraphs of a book you like and admire, and just study the punctuation. What's the author doing? Why did she break that sentence that way? Why did she want a pause there? How much of the rhythm of the prose is actually established by the punctuation? How's it done? A week later. It may be interesting, now, to go through your workshop piece and punctuate it. The unpunctuated passage had to find a way to make itself clear without punctuation. To punctuate it may involve rewriting it. Which version do you think works better? A four-part sentence I read as a child in a book of puzzles demonstrates quite spectacularly the power of punctuation in general and the purpose of the semicolon in particular. Unpunctuated, it is as follows. All that is all, that is not, that is not, that is not, that is all. All you need to make it make sense is three semicolons. You could use all periods, but it would be jerky.